You're listening to the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at cvillepodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at cvillepodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up today. I'm Dan Gould. Regular listeners of our podcast might know Rick Britton. He's an historian and cartographer and a frequent guest on WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Rick also organizes a Civil War lecture and day trip series in conjunction with the Charlottesville Senior Center. On Wednesday, July 21st, 2010, National Park Service historian Robert Crick spoke on the Battle of Malvern Hill. Fought on July 1st, 1862, Malvern Hill, located approximately 15 miles southeast of Richmond, pitted Confederate General Robert E. Lee's 85,000 men against a similar number under the Union General George B. McClellan. In the afternoon, following a furious artillery engagement, Confederate forces made repeated futile assaults, losing over 5,000 in the bloody work. This is the third in a six-part series for 2010. Here's Robert Crick.
All right, well, I'm pleased and happy to see so many people out here in the middle of the week on an early evening, that people who are obviously interested enough in the Civil War and in battles to devote the better part of your evening to listening to some stranger stand up here and talk to you. That's a good sign. That's the sort of thing that makes me happy. Now, I'm going to spend about 40 minutes rewarding you or punishing you, depending on your point of view, with some details on what has become in the last 15 years the best preserved Civil War battlefield in Central Virginia. It's not the best battlefield in Virginia. Several people could argue about what that might be, but it's the best preserved, most intact, least changed, least altered Civil War battlefield landscape in Central Virginia. And after I tell you what happened there and why it's interesting, why it's important, what I think about it, I'll tell you a little bit about how we got to this excellent condition, how Malvern Hill went in the last 15 years from having 130 preserved acres to having nearly 1,500 preserved acres, just in the space of a decade and a half. I'll tell you a little bit about how that happened and what it means in the short term and the long term. Now, I passed around among you and handed out a map. Hope all of you got one. I barely brought enough, it turns out. And it's actually a double-sided map, and it will be your companion here for the next while. Maps are so critical when you're studying Civil War battles or campaigns. And since we're not sitting here with a great big panoramic picture window looking out on the Malvern Hill battlefield, I can't go into great detail. I'll leave that to Professor Britton next week when you're out on the battlefield. But I'm going to help prep you a little bit and give you some big picture and some medium picture things, and then a little bit of detail about the battle itself and why it's significant. So for a while at least, you ought to take a look at the map that shows the whole greater Richmond area. It says George Skoke in the bottom left corner, George Skoke being a famous Civil War cartographer. And this is one of George's best maps because it's so important in studying the battlefields around Richmond to recognize and appreciate the role that geography played on the course of the campaign. And we'll step back and look from a great distance for just a moment at the beginning of the campaign. Make sure you all understand the nuts and bolts of it. Civil War historians sometimes refer to this as the Peninsula Campaign, but when they say the Peninsula Campaign, they usually mean the entire six-month or five-and-a-half-month block of time from March of 1862 all the way into mid-August of 1862, when the United States Army, under George McClellan, just a young fellow, younger than anyone in this room now, I'm pained to say, now that I've passed the age that General McClellan was when he commanded the United States Army, General McClellan brought an army of ultimately almost 120,000 men up Virginia's peninsula. He landed down near Fort Monroe. He inched his way to Yorktown. He tiptoed through Williamsburg and continued up the peninsula slowly through New Kent County, Virginia, with his eyes fixed on Richmond, the capital city of the Confederacy. His adversary for much of that time in the early period of the Peninsula Campaign was Joseph Johnston. And Joe Johnston backpedaled his way up Virginia's peninsula into the outskirts of Richmond. And he determined that he was going to fight for the fate of the capital city, not just of Virginia, but of the Confederate States of America. Many of you know Joe Johnston, the Army commander, fell wounded in the Battle of Seven Pines, which has nothing to do with tonight's talk, except it opened the way for a new commander of the Confederate Army. And that commander, of course, was Robert Edward Lee. Took over on June 1, on a Sunday morning, in 1862. And General Lee could not possibly have inherited a less pleasant situation. His army was outnumbered at that time 2-1. He had somewhere in the neighborhood of 75 or 100,000 civilians at his back in the city of Richmond. The city was on the verge of going under siege. The might of the United States Navy patrolled the James River. How could General Lee not only save the city, but drive the United States Army away from it and turn the course of the war on its head? Well, he looked at a map not unlike the one you're looking at, except for his was covered with troops, and he saw that the great vulnerability of General McClellan and his invading northern troops, the great vulnerability was the railroad, the supply line, the Richmond and York River Railroad, which you can see running due east from Richmond on your map all the way over to the right margin of your map at White House Landing. And we often forget how important supplying an army was. Some of you have heard me say before, it's a feature in almost every talk that I've ever given in the last 15 years. General McClellan's army required a minimum of 700 tons of material every day just to operate. A minimum of 700 tons. And the only way he could bring that massive weight to the front lines outside Richmond was by water, through the Chesapeake Bay, up the York River, past Yorktown, up to the Pamunkey River, which was navigable, and then he would offload those supplies at White House Landing on the far eastern end of your map, and he would bring them in by railroad. That railroad was and still is a single track. It's not even a two-way track. And so the logistical burdens were that much greater on General McClellan. And he was barely tottering and stumbling toward a siege of Richmond. Some historians have argued that if things had lasted 3 or 4 more weeks, his own infrastructure may have collapsed upon himself, upon itself. He barely was keeping his head above water logistically. General Lee looked at this map. He saw that that railroad extended for a long distance to White House Landing, and he determined that he himself, Lee, would leave a small force in front of Richmond to the east, and he would strike. That was General Lee's plan on many battlefields during the Civil War. Leave something in place and attack. He was relentlessly aggressive, and it stood him in good stead here in these battles around Richmond. And so that's what he did. 3 weeks after taking command, he brought in Stonewall Jackson's army from the Shenandoah Valley, coming through Charlottesville on the way, made a forced march, got above General McClellan's army, and threatened his railroad. And General McClellan, once his railroad was in peril, tucked himself in like a sea anemone, like someone had touched him. He just kind of pulled in his claws. He abandoned offensive operations. He knew he could not control his railroad. If the Confederates got there first, they would destroy it, and then where would he be? And so General McClellan determined to retreat. Not panic-stricken retreat, but intellectual, clearly thought-out, planned retreat to save his army. That series of operations, all part of the Peninsula Campaign, is what historians call the 7 Days Battles. We like to argue about when the 7 days began and when they ended, and I won't bore you with the details of that. It gives us something to argue about. But the last of the 7 days battles, by everyone's agreement, was Malvern Hill, which is what I'm supposed to be talking about tonight, what you all are going to see next week. The 7 days battles were a series of running affairs where the Confederates had seized the initiative. The fate of Richmond was no longer in question. General Lee was chasing the Union Army away from Richmond, south and southeast toward the James River. I want you to find 2 locations here on your big picture map before we start talking more specifically. One of them is in the lower right corner, almost, and that's Harrison's Landing on the James River. I bet most of you have been there one time or another. It's a famous tourist destination. Berkeley Plantation is on Harrison's Landing, so you've been down there for one reason or another, most of you. That was the destination of McClellan's army. He couldn't just operate independently without supplies for more than a couple of days. He'd lost his railroad due to Lee's aggressiveness, so instead he determined he would use the James River to regroup, rebuild his army, start from scratch. And so the entire 7 days battles is McClellan trying to reach Harrison's Landing and the safety and security of the James River, and General Lee chasing at him, nipping at his heels, trying to bite off chunks of the Union Army and win some decisive battles. The other place I want you to find is Malvern Hill, not unreasonably, and that's off to the northwest of Harrison's Landing, about 2 inches on your map. You all see Malvern Hill on there. See how close it is to one of those northern loops or bends in the James River, and that will become important. We won't worry about the most of the other battles that preceded Malvern Hill. The big battles of the 7 days were Mechanicsville on June the 26th. That's northeast of Richmond, if you're following along. Gaines's Mill on June the 27th, which is the largest of the 7 days battles. It's east-northeast of Richmond. The armies then crossed the Chickahominy River, which runs through the middle of your map from northwest to southeast. It's a big swamp, more than a river. They fought at Savage's Station on the railroad, due east of the city of Richmond. Hopefully you all see Savage's on there. That was on June the 29th. They fought on June the 30th, nearing exhaustion, both armies. They fought on June the 30th south of Savage's Station at an intersection called Glendale on this map. Those of you with Confederate proclivities or relatives in the 19th Virginia from Charlottesville, you would know that as the Battle of Fraser's Farm. They only call it Glendale north of the Potomac River. In the south, it's the Battle of Fraser's Farm. That was on June the 30th. And after that unsatisfying, inconclusive battle, from either perspective, Union or Confederate, the armies gathered themselves for the final contest at Malvern Hill itself. Now, Malvern Hill, as you will see next week, was extremely defensible. General McClellan's army, think about 120,000 men marching across country. How many miles of roads would that clog up? Countless miles. Every road in the county was covered with blue-clad Union soldiers moving toward the James River. And so while part of his army had already reached the river, the rear of General McClellan's army reached Malvern Hill. They found it was a very satisfying position. They turned around. They faced their tormentors, Robert E. Lee's army, coming from the north, and invited Lee to attack. They'd had enough of being pushed around. They hoped the Confederates would be imprudent enough to launch an attack against Malvern Hill. And as you all know, of course, the Confederates did. Now, having learned a little bit about the big picture, why don't you switch over to the more detailed map, which for some reason has the number 19 in the upper right-hand corner. And that is Malvern Hill itself, the main battlefield. To quickly orient you, the Confederate formations are empty rectangles, and the Union troops are designated with black rectangles. And you can see it's a whole hodgepodge of troops jumbled up there on the crest of Malvern Hill. But make sure you see that Malvern Hill, the crest of Malvern Hill, right in the center of your map, there's a big W there in the middle of your map to denote a historic house, the West House. That width at the crest of Malvern Hill is very, very narrow. Look to the right and to the left, and you see those streams, Western Run and what they call Turkey Run on this map. They frame or border the east and west side of Malvern Hill. So for those of you who have not been to Malvern Hill before, you should extinguish from your mind's eye any comparisons between Malvern Hill and Little Round Top at Gettysburg, or Malvern Hill and Marie's Heights at Fredericksburg, or Malvern Hill and Missionary Ridge in Tennessee, if you want an extreme example. It's not like that. In fact, I always tell people when I'm out there with people who've never been there before, I always, when they climb off the bus or step out of their car, give them a chance to look around, and then I say, you're disappointed, aren't you? And usually they are, especially if they come armed with some advanced knowledge, because Malvern Hill was such a good defensive position. The Confederates suffered so terribly on the afternoon of July the 1st attacking Malvern Hill that everyone thinks it ought to be some sort of a fortress, like a Monte Cassino in Italy in World War II or something like that. It's not. It's just a very ordinary, pedestrian-looking piece of high ground. Its power is not in its elevation. Its power was in its field of fire. And you will see that yourselves next week when you go out there. There were almost no trees to the north of Malvern Hill. Any Confederates attacking up the north slope of the hill from north to south had to cross anywhere between 900 and 1,300 yards of open space. And because the hill was not so high, because it's a gentle hill, there was no dead ground. By that I mean there was no low space at the bottom of the hill where the Confederates who were attacking could find shelter or protection. There was no place across that 10, 11, 1,200 yard attack route where one would not be exposed to enemy fire. And that is the ideal situation for a Civil War defensive battle. Your enemy has to cross a huge amount of open space and they have nowhere to hide, nowhere, no way to sneak up close. That's why Malvern Hill was so important and so impressive. The slope itself is fairly gentle. Now, General Lee, let me spare a couple of minutes to talk about Robert E. Lee before we talk about the battle. General Lee had, on the morning of July the 1st, what for him was a temper tantrum. General Lee, although people talk about him all the time, they write about him all the time, some people name their children after him, Robert E. Lee is still misunderstood in some respects. Too much of the public's perception of General Lee, in my opinion, has been shaped by television, which of course shapes everything, and more specifically, the famous novel, Killer Angels, which I'm sure some of you have read, some of you adore it. It's a famous piece of prose, of written splendor. But it's fiction. Never pretends to be anything other than fiction. And in Killer Angels and in subsequent television renderings of General Lee, he is portrayed as stiff and icy and unapproachable. Now, working for the Park Service like I do, I deal with visiting public quite a bit. I don't spend my whole life circulating around talking to interested groups. I talk to uninterested groups from time to time, and also just regular visitors who show up on the battlefields. And you'd be surprised how many of them think that General Lee was cold and icy. And that's not really true. He may have been like that on the day of a battle, and that's perfectly understandable, but there's two parts of Lee that are not like that at all. And we see one of them here on the morning of Malvern Hill. He did have a very strong temper, like strong personalities often do. He generally did not show it to his peers, kept good control of himself, but he showed it around his family, and he showed it around his personal staff, the people he was with every day. I have an entire talk about Robert E. Lee's staff in which I devote 10 or 15 minutes to examples of General Lee losing his temper in a perfectly human way with his own staff about petty things sometimes, and then immediately apologizing, regretting that he had lost the grip for just a tiny moment on his famous self-control. If he'd snapped at one of his staff, he'd take him an apple the next morning, or a glass of buttermilk, or some sort of token apology to show that he regretted losing his temper. The other thing that people don't understand is General Lee's sense of humor, which has nothing to do with Malvern Hill, and I won't talk about that, but he was actually more playful and teasing and droll than your average American in the 19th or the 21st century. And he's misunderstood that way, too. But on the morning of Malvern Hill, General Lee let loose with his temper in a public setting. The Army had failed to win a great victory the afternoon before at Fraser's Farm or at Glendale, and he knew that the Union Army had pulled up on the crest of Malvern Hill and that it was liable to be a difficult business to drive them away, to win the big victory that he really wanted. And so some of his subordinates, several generals, had gathered around and were making conversation in the presence of the commanding general, and somebody, I think it was Jubal Early, actually, said to General Lee, "Well, General, what are our prospects for this morning? Are we going to be able to drive the Yankees off Malvern Hill?" And General Lee said, "No, our prospects are grim. I can't get anybody to follow my orders." Snapped his mouth shut and left it at that, which for him is an eruption, a temper tantrum. And it is our only clue to what must have been his great frustration. Here he was, he just started to win one of the great campaigns of the Civil War. He'd saved his capital city. Things were looking good, but he still could not win a victory that meant a lot, a battlefield victory where he could really hurt the Yankees. And he was irritated. He'd seen opportunity slip away. That was his state of mind on the morning of July the 1st. He was also extremely tired, as was everyone in both armies. So Lee established a plan. He realized, and this is a very important point, he realized that he could not charge up the slopes of Malvern Hill and win. A lot of people compare Malvern Hill to Gettysburg, Gettysburg being everyone's common denominator. Even people who don't know much about the Civil War, they know about Pickett's Charge or they've been to Gettysburg. They have that as a point of reference. And Malvern Hill does have some similarities. When you get out there, if you've not seen it before, great big wide open field, and in the final analysis, Lee did send his infantry straight up the hill into the teeth of a roaring line of Union artillery, so it looks a little bit like Gettysburg. The big difference was that Gettysburg was pre-planned to go that way, more or less. Malvern Hill was not. When Lee first made a reconnaissance of Malvern Hill and he saw the strength of the Union position, there were 35 Union cannon on that gentle crest controlling all of the approaches to Malvern Hill. Nobody was going to charge that and win. So General Lee determined that he would test the position. And if things broke his way, perhaps he could win the battle after all. If not, he would lay off. He would not gamble and attack the crest of Malvern Hill. And so the key to Robert E. Lee's plan to win the Battle of Malvern Hill was to take advantage of the narrowness at the top of the hill. I told you, it's not very far from one slope to the other. You see those two ravines on either side of the hill. In fact, it's only 900 yards from the western bluff of Malvern Hill, what they call locally Malvern Cliffs, which by Virginia standards, they are kind of cliffs. No one's going to confuse them with New Mexico or Arizona, but in Virginia, they're cliffs. 900 yards east, and another abrupt precipice dropping down to Western Run. So there's only room for 35 Union cannon on that narrow front. General Lee's army is spread out over 2 miles in a great big semicircle approaching Malvern Hill. So General Lee, with some assistance from James Longstreet, one of his top subordinates at this point, they crafted a plan where they would create a crossfire. And I know this is fairly detailed, but it's an important point because it really provoked everything else that happened. Crossfires are always desirable if you're the one delivering the crossfire on a battlefield. Doesn't matter if you're fighting with 18th century weapons in the Revolutionary War or modern weapons, crossfire from two converging separate angles on a single target is always good, militarily speaking. In fact, I have a quote here, just in case you doubt me. This from a Confederate. Has nothing to do with Malvern Hill, but he's writing about this very specifically after the war. He said, there are two expressions in the military vocabulary that describe situations usually fatal to the party occupying them. The first of which is that terrible word flanked, and the second is artillery crossfire. These are two things to avoid if you're on the defensive, getting flanked or being subjected to an artillery crossfire. And the Confederates could do it. They could set up that crossfire. And you can see on your map, if you're well-oriented, if you see where the Confederate positions are, you can see the artillery crossfire. If you look north of the center of your map, raise your eyes from the center about 2 or 3 inches. To your left a little bit, you will see Magruder's artillery. There's a whole series of little cannon symbols. You look another couple of inches to the east, next to Stonewall Jackson's name, and you see Jackson's artillery. You all spot that? A little bit north of center. Magruder's artillery, Jackson's artillery. Notice how they are not pointing in the same direction. They're pointing for a crossfire. They are lobbing their deadly cannon shells onto the crest of Malvern Hill, hopefully with good effect. And General Lee believed that if he could silence the Union cannon on top of Malvern Hill, get that horrible menace out of the way, that then his own infantry, his own foot soldiers, had enough discipline and valor and determination that they could carry the top of the hill. If it was infantry against infantry, he knew he would win. But he was frightened of the Union artillery, with good cause. And so this crossfire was going to suppress the Union batteries on top of Malvern Hill, and then the Confederates, once that happened, they would launch an all-out attack. Well, didn't go so well. Confederates had a variety of impediments. They had a hard time getting enough cannon up. You see Magruder's artillery there, looking very fearsome and ferocious. In fact, General Magruder never got more than 8 or 9 cannon into position at any single time. Instead of having 40 or 50 roaring guns as that part of the crossfire, he had 8 or 9. Stonewall Jackson, on the other side of the road to the east, he did a little bit better. He may have had as many as 10 or 15 cannon operating all at once, but they were outgunned. The Union guns were superior. They had better equipment, they had better shells, they had better fuses, they had better trained artillerymen. And the Confederate crossfire, instead of silencing Malvern Hill, Malvern Hill silenced the Confederate crossfire. Backfired on General Lee. Well, unfortunately, in a bizarre piece of poor command and control, as they say in the modern armed forces, command and control, how an army is maneuvered by its leaders, listen to the orders that General Lee's headquarters had issued about this crossfire. This is a copy of a dispatch that was sent to all of Lee's top subordinates. It said, and this is a direct quote, imagine if you're a Confederate general and you receive this note from General Lee. It says, batteries have been established to act upon the enemy's line. If it is broken, as is probable, General Armstead, who can witness the effect of the fire, has been ordered to charge with a yell. Do the same. Period. All right, so dissect that a little bit. You get that order. You're a mile from the crest of Malvern Hill. There are 75,000 Confederates in the vicinity, 90,000 Union troops around the high ground on Malvern Hill here and there. And your trigger for launching an all-out attack up the slope of Malvern Hill is the yelling of General Armstead's brigade. You suppose that's the only yelling on the battlefield at Malvern Hill. How does General Armstead's brigade yell differently than every other brigade, one might wonder? And that is the same General Armstead destined to be killed at Gettysburg the following summer. General Armstead was chosen for this peculiar task because his command was closest to the base of Malvern Hill. They were out on skirmishing duty. If the Confederate crossfire really did silence the guns of Malvern Hill, Armstead would know how he was going to convey that. He was going to start yelling. Well, the crossfire failed. General Armstead's men had no cause for yelling. Battlefield grew fairly silent. General Lee, disgusted, but not completely beaten yet, determined that he would see if he could go around Malvern Hill. If a straight-up-the-hill assault wasn't in the cards, how about going around it using maneuver? And so General Lee took some of his staff, and he rode off of your map. Don't know exactly where he was. He was somewhere off to the eastern side of your map, looking for a way around Malvern Hill to get between the hill and the James River. Well, turns out he couldn't do that. There wasn't room, but he was trying. While he was gone, the details, the sequence, a little bit fuzzy, but while he was gone, General Lee received 2 different messages from men back at Malvern Hill. One of the messages said, the Union Army is retreating. What should we do? A little bit later, second message, there's dust. Union cannon are being pulled off the top of Malvern Hill. What should we do? And General Lee, led into the belief that the Union Army really was leaving Malvern Hill, said, by all means, don't let them get away. Press them. Well, Union Army wasn't retreating, of course. Well, I don't know what they were doing. They were changing horses on their cannon, bringing up new ammunition, something of the sort. Furthermore, if you think that's not bad enough, an attack triggered by a misunderstanding, some generals in Lee's army still thought that the old order about General Armstead yelling was in effect. Not every general got the cancellation, that those orders were obsolete. And so, through a series of terrible misunderstandings, poor staff work, coincidences, Confederate Army launched a frontal assault up the slopes of Malvern Hill, the worst possible thing they could have done, the thing General Lee was trying to avoid all morning and all early afternoon. General Daniel Harvey Hill, for instance, division commander under Robert E. Lee, was holding a meeting with his five brigade commanders, five generals immediately subordinate to him. He still thought the orders were in effect. He heard some cheering, some yelling. He said, "Oh no, there goes General Armistead with his yelling. That's the signal, we need to attack." And that is how many of the Confederate waves of attack were launched. Through this series of misunderstandings, General Lee rode back to see what was happening and was appalled to discover what he had unleashed. Certainly not the way he had planned it. He had to decide instantly whether he should just say, "Stop! Everybody leave. We'll cut our losses." Or try and press the attack, see if he could make the best of the bad situation that he was in, and he chose that latter option. He organized his men, he rode around exhorting them, told General Magruder to get busy, throw more troops in, see if he could get around Malvern Hill, and the attack was on. And in all of my experience studying Civil War battlefields, I find it hard to discover many other battles that were more poorly managed, I'm compelled to say. There was disorganization at every level. Let me read you a couple of accounts from Georgia soldiers, not Virginians here, not North Carolinians, but Georgians who were right at the foot of Malvern Hill, who did their best to go up the hill, who saw their comrades shot down by the hundreds, and who wrote about it. This lieutenant was writing for his hometown newspaper a couple of days after the battle, while it was fresh in his mind. He said the confusion was sublimely ridiculous. But the troops were not to blame. They were brave enough. They entered the field like veterans, but the whole thing lacked plan. The enemy held a formidable position, the brow or crest of a hill, and the nature of the ground was such that their lines described an angle of about 115 degrees, or the arc of a circle. Brigade after brigade rushed into this vortex, and those coming last, not knowing who was in front, fired with deadly effect into their own friends, very naturally causing a panic in the front brigades, who, of course, thought they were flanked. And as you play this out in your mind's eye, you can see it getting worse and worse, every error compounding and making the situation worse for the next men in line. General Magruder, I must say, did a dismal job in organizing his attack. He threw his men forward in waves. It's the traditional analogy, like waves at the beach. Instead of sending 20,000 men forward at once, he'd send them forward 4,000 or 5,000 at a time. They'd get stopped, they'd fall back, the next line would come up and run into them. This from another Georgian. He said, "No orders came for us to move either forward or backward. Finally, our colonel gave the command to fall back, and we rose to execute the order." They'd given up. "The sun had set to twilight and was almost on us. Now I witnessed the effect of leaving a battlefield under fire. When we started back, there was no disorder. But in 1 minute's time, the officers, in spite of every effort, lost control of the men, and they became a disorganized mass. Another lieutenant and I walked off, determined not to set the example of flight, but it was very agreeable to us to walk fast." Which is a nice quote. Very agreeable to us to walk fast. Although there are many nuances to the battle, which I will leave for your site visit next week, conventional wisdom, in my opinion, about Malvern Hill is accurate, that the Union artillery, the cannon at the top of Malvern Hill, were the most important element, the decisive factor in blasting back these various Confederate attacks. You can see them all here with arrows. You see Magruder. You see UG, spelled H-U-G-E-R. You see D.H. Hill's division attacking. Eventually, some of Stonewall Jackson's men went into the attack belatedly. Very piecemeal, haphazard, out of rhythm. But that Union artillery controlled the field. There was no place one could go and be safe. And some of you perhaps have heard the famous statistic, or the famous fact, it's not a statistic, that the roar of guns at Malvern Hill was so great that the battle was heard in Stanton, which means, I presume, it was heard in Charlottesville as well. It's almost exactly 100 miles on a straight line from the Malvern Hill battlefield westward to Stanton. Now, acoustics have something to do with this. The The atmosphere had to be exactly right for that to happen. If you could hear it in Stanton, and this is from a couple of separate diary entries. This is not somebody reminiscing in 1910. These are actual diary entries about hearing the noise. But if you could hear it in Stanton, what do you suppose it sounded like at the base of Malvern Hill? Not very good. Not very good. The row of cannon that the Park Service have put up there at the crest of Malvern Hill, we have six original guns up there on the crest. That one battery of six cannon that we're trying to show people, that we use as an example, it's a real battery that we're depicting, it fired 1,392 rounds from just those six guns during the Battle of Malvern Hill. So you take that and you multiply it by 100 cannon from start to finish, and you can understand why Malvern Hill was so, so deadly and so important. A North Carolinian writing about this after the war described the futility of the attack, inability to get close. He summed it up by saying, "The enemy opened the most terrific and destructive fire in the face of my regiment that anyone has ever met since the world began." So he just was going right to the ultimate example. The most destructive fire in the history of military operations in the world confronted his regiment. That gives you some idea about how bad it was for him. Now, General Lee, trying to salvage a little bit, did take advantage of the steeply sloped eastern and western sides of Malvern Hill. Malvern Cliffs, I was telling you, over on the western side. Eventually, he put some of the Confederates around, and that steep side of the hill, allowed them to at least form up invisible to the Union troops on the crest of the hill. And I'm sure you'll walk out there next week. It's covered with woods today. It was open historically, and that changes things quite a bit. I'll tell you about that in a minute. But they did form up down there in the bottom, and then they charged up the steepest part of the hill. They still didn't get to the top of the hill, but at least that reduced their casualties. And perhaps a casualty that will mean something to you all among the hundreds and hundreds of them over there was a North Carolinian from Haywood County, North Carolina, named William Inman. He was wounded. He was the real relative of the fellow who wrote the famous novel Cold Mountain, which was turned into a movie. I'm sure some of you have read Cold Mountain, which was loosely based on this fellow's relative. Well, he was a real North Carolinian, and he was shot on the slopes of Malvern Hill, and that may have helped motivate him to be a chronic deserter for the rest of the war. He's constantly leaving the army and going back to North Carolina, and that's the substance, at least the bare bones outline, for Cold Mountain. And he was one of the many, many Confederate casualties, 5,000 Confederate casualties, attacking the slope of Malvern Hill. As with every other battle of the 7 days, the sun set and ended the battle, and inevitably, one side or the other was glad that the sun went down. In this case, it was the Confederates. Put an end to the fight. General McClellan had won the battle by any definition. You will never find a Confederate source that claims Malvern Hill as a victory. It's a clear-cut defeat. However, as they're always quick to point out, McClellan left, and the Confederates controlled the battlefield the next morning. But there was no reason for McClellan to stay. He had turned around and admonished the Confederate pursuers, swatted them, but he still needed to go to the James River. He still had to supply his army, still had to regroup and reorganize, so he left. The next morning, his rear guard, a small detachment of cavalry, looked out from the crest of Malvern Hill back into the teeth of the Confederate attack zone, and the commander of the rear guard left a very famous account that I'm sure you've heard some of you before, talking about the battlefield and what it looked like and the countless Confederate casualties, dead and wounded. He said they were in every attitude of distress, curled up or sprawling singly and in heaps and rows, but enough of them were living and moving to give the field a crawling appearance. It's a very eerie and descriptive account from a Union officer, a crawling appearance. Told you that some of General McClellan's men were disappointed. They'd finally won a battle and they were still leaving. The retreat continued. The most famous protester was a general, Philip Kearny. One-armed Phil Kearny lost an arm in the Mexican War and was noted for being outspoken and belligerent and grumpy and shrill and unreasonable and brave. All of those things. His men loved him, his superiors not so much. And General Kearny, in a fit of insubordination, stood up when he learned that the army was retreating after this clear-cut victory, and he said, "I, Philip Kearny, an old soldier, enter my solemn protest against this order to retreat. Instead of retreating, we ought to follow up the enemy and take Richmond. And in full view of all the responsibility of such a declaration, I say to you all that such an order can only be prompted by cowardice and treason. That's directed specifically at George McClellan, the Army commander. And that alone gives us a little bit of a window into the unstable set of affairs then in the United States Army. They had just been driven from Richmond. They'd lost most of the battles. Their hopes of ending the war by the 4th of July were over. Everybody was a little uptight about it. But in good, well-managed, tightly run, effective armies, generals don't stand up and say stuff like that. If you did it in Europe, you'd be killed, executed. In the United States, you can get away with it a little bit, but it was still pretty extreme. As one Union soldier said after the battle, when General McClellan issued a pompous proclamation about how successful the campaign had been, how he really wanted to change his base anyway. He was intending to move to the James River, and this just kind of sped things up a little bit. It's a great series of victories. As a Union soldier wrote, he said, if these are victories, I'd hate to know what a defeat looks like. The total casualties at Malvern Hill, casualties don't always tell the story, but people like to know them, and they are important. They add value and meaning to the land, if nothing else. You stand at the crest of Malvern Hill, and you look out, and you say, 5,000 Confederate soldiers were killed or wounded on that slope, or on those slopes. 5,000. And they're fortunate that it wasn't even more. Union casualties, McClellan's own losses at the crest of Malvern Hill, were greater than one would think. About 3,000. The ratio is only 5 to 3. Should have been worse. What that tells us, what we can infer from it, from breaking down the casualties a little bit more, is that many Confederates, despite the many travails they had to overcome, they got close enough to engage in firefights. They got within 100 yards of the crest of Malvern Hill, and they were giving and taking volleys of rifle fire, because we know the Confederate cannon didn't inflict those casualties. Confederate infantry did. It shows that they at least put up a good fight in a battle that they could not possibly win. I told you a little bit about preservation and why Malvern Hill is now a destination for you and for many others. 19 years ago, in 1991, Malvern Hill was the most threatened battlefield in the United States, immediately threatened. There was a conditional use permit from the local county for a gravel company to excavate a gravel pit on top of Malvern Hill. Park Service only owned one side of the road, the west side of the road. East side of the road, apparently that whole area, in fact, is very rich in gravel. You drive down there, you spend enough time, and you see gravel pits all over that part of Henrico County. And the permit had been issued, and preservationists, figuratively speaking at least, chained themselves to the conveyor belt and stopped the thing. And once that had happened, the Association for the Preservation of Civil War Sites, which was the first big national Civil War preservation, battlefield preservation group, the old APCWS, worked out a deal to buy not that land, but 750 adjacent acres. Park Service owned 130. The APCWS bought 750, including almost all of the Confederate attack zone in front of Malvern Hill. And they bought so much that it extended off your map to the north, all the way up to the old Frazier's Farm or Glendale battlefield. So far, so good. That was in 1992, 1993, something like that. They have continued to chip away. The APCWS does not exist anymore. It has morphed into the Civil War Preservation Trust, which now is the big national battlefield preservation organization. And it's impossible for me to exaggerate how effective and successful they have been. Very admirable, not just in Virginia, not just around my own beloved battlefields around Richmond, but all across the country, people who cherish battlefield landscapes and the stories that are connected with them owe the trust a big thanks. Now, as they'll be quick to tell you, they have saved 28,000 acres of land in just less than 20 years, 28,000 acres of battlefield land in just less than two decades. And they have cobbled together several other parcels, including the one where the gravel pit was slated to go. They bought that about 5 or 6 years ago. They turned these over to the National Park Service incrementally. They bought up most of the Glendale or Frazier's Farm battlefield from the day before. That's been achieved within the last 3 or 4 years. And the preservation has been so great that in the future, not next week, but in the future, the capability now exists for someone to start at the upper end of the June 30th battlefield, the Glendale-Fraser's Farm battlefield, the northern tip of that battlefield, and walk without leaving unpreserved battlefield land for 3.1 miles all the way to the bottom of the Malvern Hill battlefield. We have 3.1 contiguous miles of preserved battlefield land. Now, in a couple of places, it's pretty narrow, just 20 or 30 yards wide, but it is contiguous, and it really is a startling difference and an improvement over what it used to be. There was very early talk about preservation, but in a different sense. Malvern Hill, the wartime owner of Malvern Hill, went bankrupt and had to sell the estate. Malvern Hill was a great old 17th century mansion, and the farm where the battle took place was part of the Malvern Hill mansion. The wartime owner, Mr. Dew, D-E-W, had to sell off the property, and it was bought by a wealthy carpetbagger from Ohio, a veteran of Sherman's army, had fought in Georgia and the Carolinas, and he established at Malvern Hill a sort of a tourist trap, a 19th century version of a tourist trap. He was an entrepreneur. He created what are called Malvern Hill bricks. Have any of you seen Malvern Hill bricks? None of you? These were commemorative things. They were bricks that were made right there on the battlefield. He stamped a cannon on it, said Malvern Hill 1861, 1865, and he sold them to tourists. Tourists will buy anything, even in the 19th century. His purpose was to raise money for a monument at the Malvern Hill battlefield that he proposed to make. He said, I want to build a monument on the highest point of Malvern Hill where it can be seen for 20 miles around, and I want it to be a national affair with a statue of honest old Abe Lincoln on the top of it. Such a monument as I propose to erect could be seen from Richmond with a field glass. And I think it should face towards Richmond. And he then goes on to say that his souvenir cannon brick, available at only 50 cents a brick, will help him realize that ideal of putting an Abraham Lincoln monument on the crest of Malvern Hill. Well, that never happened. I don't know what happened to the carpetbagger. He left. The bricks are still around. They're very collectible. You see them for $125 or so at Civil War shows. If you can find one that hasn't have a corner broken off of it or a crack through it, it's even more valuable because, of course, they don't age well. They're bricks. But they're very collectible, and that's the beginning of preservation at Malvern Hill. We had a 100-year lapse where nothing happened, and now we own almost all of the battlefield. And Park Service has done the best we can. We can do everything but actually force visitors to go there. Now, Malvern Hill is the remotest of all of the Richmond area battlefields, 15 miles from downtown Richmond. Family of four showing up from Salt Lake City on their vacation. They want to tour the national parks. They come to Richmond and they say, what can we do and where can we go? And we'll tell them that the driving tour is 60 miles, covers 11 different battlefields, and it's not contiguous. You have to drive through long stretches of traffic to connect the dots from battlefield to battlefield. It's very disheartening for many visitors who aren't there for a really zealous visit to the battlefields. And so our chronic problem always is getting visitors out to Malvern Hill. If they're only going to go to a few battlefields, they go to Cold Harbor, or they go to the outer defenses of Richmond or Drury's Bluff on the James River. Very often they just go to the visitor centers, like you all are going to do next week. But you're redeeming yourselves by then continuing on to the Malvern Hill battlefield afterwards. And at Malvern Hill, we have cleared about 60 acres of trees. There's a great myth roaming around that the Park Service battlefields don't like to restore the landscape, that the naturalists have complete control over historic sites. And that's not strictly true either. Maybe it varies from battlefield to battlefield. Gettysburg has gotten a lot of positive publicity lately for rehabilitating their battlefield, for planting trees where there were trees in 1863, for removing trees where there weren't trees in 1863. And Fredericksburg has been doing the same thing since the 1970s, and they've done almost everything they can. And we've been doing the same thing with great pride and satisfaction around Richmond since the 1990s as well. And that entailed removing a lot of trees at Malvern Hill so that now, as you stand at the crest like a Union soldier behind one of those cannon, you duplicate the vista that they had in 1862, and it injects much more meaning and appreciation at every level for every visitor to see the battlefield the way it was in 1862. There's a whole series of walking trails. There's brand new signs that have been installed. There's a podcast for those of you who like podcasts. We have a podcast on the Park Service website, and you can download that and go walk around with a Park Service historian in your ear and walk the trail at Malvern Hill. Gather some extra insight from that. The future is, I think, that we will probably marry up this battlefield with the Glendale or Fraser's Farm battlefield up to the north and create one integrated experience that conceivably will be the best one in Virginia. Where else can you go and walk 3.1 contiguous miles across two of the most hotly contested battlefields in Virginia during the Civil War? And it's even more meaningful for those of us who've been around there for a while because we remember when it was 130 acres and when the specter of an enormous gravel pit was shadowing us. And the progress that has been made and the opportunities that have been opened up are really gratifying for everybody who's been involved with it. And so I would encourage you all to go out there on your own, not just with Professor Britton, but on your own. I'm sure you're not going to walk the entire marathon trail. It would take you all afternoon. It would be too much. So you have many opportunities to investigate the different portions of the battlefield. And as always, when you visit a battlefield, watch what you're seeing. See how the terrain, that original landscape, affected the course of the battle. That's why people go to battlefields, to see where things happened and why the ground, which is unique, influenced the course of events. And there's no place in Central Virginia better for that than Malvern Hill. And I'm pleased that you all are going out there next week. Thank you all for listening to me tonight.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.